Welcome everyone to Concurrent 7C, and I think it's a nominee for the most interesting session title. I wanted to perhaps run a straw poll for the answer, but maybe Daniel will do that. I'm not sure what each of you think, and I might leave my opinion to the end. Our presenters today, we're very lucky to have two great presenters, Daniel Smith and Cameron Lucas. Daniel has been involved in Builder's Warranty for over 15 years and is amazed at how little has been learned from the mistakes of the past. He is strongly of the view that consumers are the losers in most schemes around Australia and that there are a small number of core fundamentals that need to be incorporated to ensure both adequate consumer protection and scheme viability. Cameron is a recently qualified fellow who has worked with Daniel for a number of years. He has less experience in Builder's Warranty, but more youthful exuberance for it. He thinks the variety of scheme designs across both the country and recent decades gives us an opportunity to learn from best practices to create effective cover across the nation. I'm really looking forward to this one. So I think Daniel first.
Thanks, Ari. Welcome to the few of you. I wasn't expecting a big crowd given the topic is reasonably bespoke, I suppose, but hopefully we can show you what we've been looking at over the last 11 years, I suppose it's been, or before that. Unfortunately, Ari, we don't get to answer the question. I came up with the title before we came up with the paper. So, anyway. Yeah, who'd have thought? I'm just going to give a very quick intro, and then I suppose one of the things that I have done over the last few years is got a bit smarter, and that means you hire someone who's much smarter than you and get them to do all the work and therefore most of the presentation. And so Cam will talk a bit about what's happened over the last 11 years, and then a little bit about the consumer's perspective, some of the scheme objectives, and I might come back and finish off with some comments on the objectives and designs. Over the last 11 years, so the reason we're talking about 11 years, 2005 I did a paper called Builder's Warranty, First Resort or Last Resort, or Does It Really Matter? And in that presentation I interviewed a range of people and playing different roles. And the young lady on the left-hand side is my five-year-old daughter who played a role in the video interviews that I did. And that's a picture of her standing in basically the same spot a month or so ago. So sometimes, you know, over 11 years, in that particular case, a lot has changed and her father is now in working out whether he needs to buy a gun. And then, of course, some things don't change. And I was hoping that David Gifford might make his way in here so he could at least see the Carlton reference. But there's two football teams where not much has changed over the last 11 years. And certainly for them, not much has changed from week to week either. In terms of Builder's Warranty Insurance, I know a lot of people in the room do know a lot about it, but I will just go through quickly some of the sort of core elements to it. It protects, the aim is to protect consumers in the event of a builder failing to complete defect-free work. So that might be failure to complete, or they might have thought they completed it and some years later you find out that it's rubbish work and the insurance is there for the consumer to be able to have those works fixed. It is compulsory in most states and has been for a long time. Often the terminology is to talk about schemes as being either first resort or last resort. The last resort schemes, which are the most common at the moment, refer to you can only make a claim in the event of particular events, and that being that the builder is dead, has disappeared or is insolvent, and there are now some additional triggers, but they sort of work around that core aspect. In last resort, typically, you're, as a consumer, your first port of call is some form of sort of consumer affairs or trying to deal with the builder yourself. In the first resort instance, you typically, if you've got a dispute with the builder and they're not playing nicely with you, then you go to that first resort body and they effectively act as the claims handler manager throughout the process, or dispute manager, I suppose, more correctly. At the moment, Queensland's the only first resort scheme in Australia. In terms of the features of builder's warranty, it's a longish tail, cover typically for six, bit maybe a bit more years, gets up to sort of 7 or 8 years often by the time you've actually taken out the contract or started your building process, and then payments up to 10 years, going out to 15 years, not unusual. It is a cyclical sort of business. It's there's good times and there's bad times, and when it's good it can be very good, and when it's bad it can be horrid. And that it has some similar characteristics to lenders' mortgage insurance in terms of being impacted by economic and sort of business cycles, obviously a building cycle in BWI. I suppose to some extent it's me, I've always called it builder's warranty insurance. The Senate Standing Committee on Economics didn't like the word warranty and said that it should be, it's not warranty, you're not providing a warranty, you're providing an insurance or you're providing something. You can see the list there of what it's called around the country, that some have still got warranty, some have just got insurance. For the sake of anything here, we're calling it builder's warranty insurance, and it's all the same to me. On that note, I'm going to hand over to Cam. He's going to take you through what's happened over the last 11 years.
G'day, everyone. So the 2005 paper that Daniel talked about gave a history to that point. We're not going to retrace much of that in this presentation. It discussed the transition to basically the private insurer scheme at the time. So prior to kind of the 2000s in the 90s, it was largely a publicly underwritten, or there were a lot of publicly underwritten schemes around Australia. So state schemes basically. There was a transition to a private insurer market, and then a transition to last resort when the first resort private insurers weren't having great experience. It highlighted the features of the insurance, as Daniel's done to some extent there, discussed the cyclical nature of the cover, and much of that 2005 paper still holds true. So that can almost act as an introduction to this paper or up to that point. So now I'm going to go through a few of the changes to the various state schemes. I'm going to kind of quickly go through them. New South Wales is one of the biggest schemes and went through quite a few changes since 2005. So in 2007, they increased cover limits. So that's basically just the maximum cover that the scheme will provide. In 2009, they introduced a new failure to comply trigger. So this is a last resort scheme, which up until 2009 meant your builder had to be DDI, so dead, disappeared, or insolvent. There was a bit of discontent that, you know, when a builder wasn't complying with court orders to do things, you actually had to push them into insolvency. So there's a legal process involved in that, and it can be costly to the consumer. So New South Wales implemented a new trigger. So it's DDI or failure to comply triggers the insurance cover. So that was at that point. In 2009-10, most private insurers, so up to that point it was a competitive market. I think there were five or six insurers were the main players in the market. Most of them started to leave the market. In 2010, as a result of insurers leaving the market, SI Corp set up the HBCF, it's just a fund, to begin basically public underwriting. So a scheme was set up by the New South Wales government to begin public underwriting. Again, cover limits have changed. 2015, HBCF became part of iCare, the newly created iCare. And there were changes to owner builders, which I won't talk about much too more in our presentation. And in 2016, so I think about a week or two ago, reforms were announced to try and bring private insurers back into the market and to introduce risk-based pricing. At the moment, the underwriting criteria are fairly limited in New South Wales. Victoria underwent...
Should just say there too, and to remove brokers, which NIBA doesn't seem particularly happy about.
There you go. Yes, so Victoria. So much the same exit from the market as happened in New South Wales in 2009-10, which meant the VMIA had to step in and begin underwriting. So it was much the same way and at the same time as New South Wales stepped in to begin underwriting their scheme. In 2013, Caledon, up until 2013, had continued underwriting, even when Victoria was underwriting. So there was almost competition with the state scheme, but they exited for licensed builders. And it wasn't until 2015 that Victoria introduced its fail to comply trigger. And VMIA have announced that in 2017 they'll change how they distribute insurance. So I think that's a similar thing, removing brokers, although there's not a whole lot of information on their website about that. Other states, rather than go through them all, in 2008, Tasmania switched to a voluntary scheme. So their response to private insurers leaving the market was to kind of go voluntary, which basically rendered the insurance unavailable in Tasmania. Private insurers aren't really willing to cover it on a voluntary basis. I think it's essentially unavailable in Tasmania. In 2009, small changes to Queensland cover to slightly expand what it covered. Again, that exit in 2009-10 was true for most states, all states virtually. In 2013, QBE announced they would withdraw from South Australia. So at that point, only QBE and I believe Caledon were the insurers for South Australia, and QBE was by far the biggest. So when they announced they were withdrawing from the South Australian market, it kind of left South Australians with a need to buy cover. It was compulsory, but no one to buy cover from. So the South Australian government provides 100% reinsurance to QBE to keep writing. So essentially they became the underwriter with QBE just acting as an agent for them, I guess. In 2013, there were reforms to Queensland scheme. So it was called the BSA. It became the QBCC. It had changes to the internal organisation, but largely the home warranty scheme itself stayed unchanged. And in 2016, just in October, Queensland has expanded the type of work covered and also introduced some optional extra cover. So that's a summary of the state of the nation at the moment. Without going through it too much, you'll see that Queensland is the only one operating a first resort scheme, and that was true back in 2005, I believe. Tasmania, it's now unavailable, essentially. Northern Territory, it used to be unavailable. I think at the time of the 2005 paper, they were introducing cover, so now it's available. And there's a range of limits there that you might be interested in, but I'm not going to talk through too much. Is there anything else that's worth mentioning on that table?
I think the key an observation from that is just in the underwriters that in 2005, the majority of the policies were issued by private insurers, and now there's pretty much none issued by private insurers, and where it is issued by private insurers, they've got some element of reinsurance cover from the states.
So here's a premium comparison for a few different states and for a few different, underwriting criteria. So along the bottom there, that's the contract value of the work being done, so essentially the amount you're paying the builder to do the work. And generally, the more work you're getting done, the more expensive the work is, the greater the risk to the insurer. So that's the premium up the left-hand side. So a few things to highlight. We've included a couple of underwriting kind of categories for New South Wales and Victoria. New South Wales rates based on whether the work is structural and non-structural and whether the work is metro or rural. So included on that plot, which I'm not sure if it's easy for everyone to see, is New South Wales structural metro and New South Wales pools and multi-dwelling work metro. I haven't included non-structural. For Victoria, Victoria rates on with different, categories of builders. So that's kind of their underwriting criteria, which they adopted from QBE, essentially, when they took over underwriting. So they separated into structural, non-structural, and I think pools and multi-dwellings have a loading as well. And we've included both Category A builders and Category C, and there's actually quite a large difference between Category A and C, so kind of the underwriting criteria used have a large impact on the premium builders in Victoria are charged. Queensland's got a slightly different shape, I guess. It's much less linear compared to the other states. So Queensland's this one that kind of picks up that orange line there. Something to note is it's not really higher than the other states, even though it provides first resort cover. So one of the biggest concerns people have about first resort cover is that it'll be more expensive to operate the scheme. So it'll be more costly for consumers to purchase. And that's not really played out for contract values less than $500,000 anyway there. Also included are South Australia and West Australia. So they're both still running private underwriting with government insurance in cases. So that's the RBUA's rating table, which is online. I couldn't find QBE's, which QBE is the much bigger player. But the RBUA is, I believe, what used to be Caledon, the Residential Building Underwriting Agency, I think it is, or something, or authority. Oh, I'm not sure. So, I mean, there's a fairly wide range there, especially at the higher end. I think that's all we want to say about premium comparison. So I'll talk about the consumer's perspective. So this is a little bit about the different scheme designs in different places and how many bodies a consumer has to go through in order to claim and to purchase insurance and how kind of complicated some of the schemes are. So in New South Wales, essentially the builder buys the insurance from a broker or the agent of HBCF and the consumer gets that cover from the builder buying it. There's also separate licensing for the builders. So in a way, we've talked about, well, we've considered the licensing of the builders as part of the underwriting criteria. So in New South Wales, the licensing is done fairly independently of the insurance side of things. There's quite a few bodies and quite a few places that a claimant would need to go through. So it can be quite confusing for a consumer to claim. Victoria's got a very similar structure. They're not on the same slide, but if I click it over, you'll see it's virtually the same picture. Different bodies, different names, but a very similar structure to the insurance that's provided. And lastly, I'll show you Queensland's structure. So Queensland has a different... a key difference is that the QBCC, the Queensland Building and Construction Commission, is much more of a one-stop shop for the building and construction kind of industry. It both licenses the builders and has the home warranty scheme in there. So a feature of that is that there can be more information about, you know, the home warranty scheme built into the licensing and vice versa. It's also, because it's a first resort scheme, consumers can generally claim to, you know, or complain and claim to the QBCC in the first place rather than having to go through QCAT or, you know, the Civil and Administrative Tribunal for Queensland. That said, everything can be appealed to QCAT, I think, from both directions, if anybody's unhappy with QBCC's final decisions. So that's probably impossible to read. It's the claims process you have to go through for each of the states, essentially. So in New South Wales, the first thing a claimant or somebody suffering a loss as a result of a defect or a non-completion is to notify the insurer of the loss. So that's even when your builder hasn't satisfied the triggers. Kind of a quirk of the New South Wales rules is you need to notify the HPCF of within 6 months of realising you have a loss. Regardless of whether you can actually lodge a claim yet, you just have to tell them, oh, there's a defect. It's unclear to us how strictly that rule's enforced. The next step is to try and directly resolve with the builder. So I guess that makes sense to most people. Attempt resolution through fair trading. So fair trading operates a kind of a mutual resolution service that both parties go through. It's largely non-enforceable and just a gesture to try and get people to resolve without going to the courts. But fair trading can send out a building inspector and issue a rectification order telling the builder essentially to comply or to, you know, they need to resolve this issue with the building. This is a real issue. Either party at any point in time can go to NCAT And that essentially short fuses the resolution and the rectification order, and NCAT can overturn a rectification order. And then finally, after going through NCAT, if a builder still fails to comply or fails to resolve an issue, then the claimant can go to the insurer. Worth pointing out, if the builder is DDI at any point, you just make a claim directly to the insurer generally. Victoria's got a similar process with different named bodies. Instead of Fair Trading, it's Consumer Affairs, and there's Building Advice in Conciliation Victoria, which is kind of supported by Consumer Affairs, before appealing to VCAT and then a claim to VMAA. Queensland, you can go directly to the QBCC. The QBCC will go through a dispute resolution process. Then the QBCC can issue a rectification order if the builder fails to comply with the rectification order, or direction to rectify, they call it. Then QBCC will rectify the issue for the consumer and then chase after the builder. So the big difference there is the consumer is not required to go through a civil and administrative tribunal. Queensland will the QBCC will do it for you. So I'm going to talk about some of the scheme objectives that we've heard bandied around, well, the two main ones, some of the considerations, and then Daniel will talk about some of the designs of schemes and their impact on the objectives. So the two main objectives are consumer protection. That's kind of the obvious one. It's a huge purchase that everybody makes, and also if you're getting construction done. And it's also something that people often only do once or twice in their life. So people aren't very familiar with the requirements and what's necessary. So it's there to protect those consumers from basically making a massive loss and having their builder go insolvent and no way to rectify the issues with their building. The second objective is the public policy objective, which is ensuring housing is complete and defect-free. It'll just improve the market overall and better outcomes for the state from a housing perspective. So one of the key considerations is the long payment pattern. So because you have many years to claim on builder's warranty insurance, you end up with a lot of payments late. So you'll see non-completions tend to come through in the first 3 to 4 years. After underwriting, they're virtually closed. But in most schemes, you have in excess of 6 years to kind of claim on a defect, and even those defects will take a long time to resolve. So quite a drawn-out process. So that's development year from underwriting, essentially. So you'll also see on the left there, we've compared the payment patterns for the Housing Guarantee Fund in Victoria up to 2005 for the QBCC's selected payment pattern for 2016. And what we think is pretty remarkable is how similar they are. Both were first resort schemes, but how similar they are, more than 10 years apart in different states, in completely different, you know, claims handling, presumably, and other processes involved. One notable difference is the QBCC's, the bimodal nature of the QBCC's distributions, slightly more pronounced, and I guess there's that later skew in the QBCC. Just up here. And we've kind of, well, we put that down to the QBCC also covers subsidence in addition to defects, so that's where the house has subsided or, you know, the ground under the house has moved. And you can see on the second graph there, subsidence has a similar payment pattern to defects in that it's late skewed. Finally, a consideration when designing a builder's warranty scheme is the volatility in the scheme. So there's a range of underwriting years. I think it's 15 underwriting years there, and the cumulative payments per policy after adjusting for inflation. So you can see outcomes can be quite varied. You've got good years, which are 50% of the claims experience of the average year, and bad years, which are 150% of the claims experience of the average year. So there's quite a bit of volatility underwriting year to underwriting year. You've also got some very late developments out here where, in that case, some 20% or so of the claim payments for that underwriting year came through in year 9 as a result of, I think that was a large defect claim on a number of units. So I think I'll move on to Daniel. Do you want to talk about some different scheme design options. They're sick of my voice, yeah.
Okay. Just back on this slide that I think is quite interesting is the not quite parallel lines, but they're not too bad. I think it highlights the need to be reserving and pricing on an underwriting year basis in builder's warranty, because you do have years that are particularly different, but a bad year tends to always be a bad year. It'll be, if it's bad for non-completions, it tends to be bad for defects and keep going through. And certainly, if you looked at that on an accident period basis, you'll have some years where it will look particularly good, and you won't know, I suppose, that this next year is going to be bad until it happens. On the underwriting year basis, I suppose you can sort of see that happen a bit more clearly, I think. There's been a whole range of reviews in builder's warranty. There seems to be a different review going on in somewhere in Australia on a continual basis. And one of the key things that comes up in arguments about the idea of having a QBC sort of scheme is debates about diversification of responsibilities, and that the fact that you've got the regulator and the insurer and the person making the decision on the claims all within the one body, and that in many cases is perceived to be a bad thing. The other argument, obviously, though, and certainly through some of the charts that Cam showed, is that you quickly develop a pretty complicated process, and certainly something in terms of navigating it from the consumer's perspective. When you've got all these different players involved, they're largely left to themselves. And I suppose if we go back to the main objective of the builder's warranty and the reason why it's compulsory in everywhere except Tasmania is to protect the consumer. And so my argument, and Cam supports it having not heard it, is that, you know, if the main aim is to protect the consumer, then the scheme should be designed in a way that provides the best protection to the consumer. And if there are issues with that design for sort of probity sorts of reasons or you know, potential audit issues, and that should be addressed in the way the body operates as opposed to the scheme being designed to solve that problem first. One of the biggest benefits that, and it's been, it was particularly clear at the Housing Guarantee Fund, and it's evident within the QBCC, is that by being able to be the regulator or the register of builders, and then looking at the insurance claims and the disputes and dealing from end to end, you've got much better control on who those builders are, what they're doing. There's less ability for the builders to shop around. It's much harder for builders to disappear and come back as somebody else, which, as you know, there's it's not that there are a huge number of dodgy builders. It's just that those that are dodgy seem to keep coming back. It's the gift that keeps on giving, I think was the term used last night, and there are certain builders that keep giving that gift. So I think that the arguments for diversification of responsibility are far weaker than the arguments for having a one-stop shop, if you like, and making sure you've got that end-to-end process. First resort or last resort. It would seem clear to me, I haven't heard an argument that ever comes up and is convincing as to why last resort would be better for the consumer. I think first resort has to be better for the consumer. The only argument that you might be able to build in would be if a first resort scheme was costing five times what last resort costs, and you could say, well, that's just too expensive for consumers. It's a compulsory product, but it's reaching a stage of being unaffordable. But the graphs that Cam put up about what premiums look like around the country would indicate that it's not necessarily the case that last resort is cheaper than first resort. And I suppose I would argue that once you've built in all the other elements of the costs, it probably comes up to be more expensive. I think the words there, does last resort provides enough cover? I think arguably it does, but the toll that consumers face when the house isn't finished, they've got nowhere to live, they're paying rent somewhere, you know, they've got to spend money on lawyers, or they don't, in which case they're even worse off because they're not well advised. Going through the civil appeals tribunals is meant to be there for the person without any money, but the reality is the more money you've got going through those, the better chance you've got of getting a good outcome, which was proven by the developers who got something up on a place right next door to me. They went to VCAT twice, threw money at it, got it through. And of course, the true cost of the design decision is just difficult to really understand without considering that whole of system dispute resolution elements of the costs. And then another element to the design is whether it should be public or private, and whether it should be competitive or monopoly. We've put those two together because I don't really think you can separate them. I think that it's got to be considered as a whole. There are a competitive public scheme, obviously, you can't have. A private monopoly, you probably can't have. So I think they go hand in hand. One of the reasons why the private insurers pulled out of the market in the late 2000s was because of the volatility that was coming through. They'd written a business, they'd had a couple of good years with not much in the way of claims, and then all of a sudden we're getting huge whacks of losses coming through, and they had no real ability to underwrite because they weren't registering the builders, so they couldn't go and they could certainly refuse cover, although it's not that often that insurers refuse cover. They prefer the premium, it seems. But when the experience went bad, the insurers were reporting losses. Their CEOs, boards, shareholders weren't particularly keen with the results, and as a result, they got out of it. And another element, reason for getting out of it, is that the premium pool within builders' warranty just isn't big enough for the insurers to be that interested in accepting that volatility in their profit. And there's not the access to reinsurance in the same way, and you can't really get a design for reinsurance cover that takes out the volatility within builder's warranty in the same way that you might do through, you know, house and motor insurance. One of the key issues, I suppose, as to why governments, in terms of builders' warranty, keep wanting to push the private insurers back into it is being coming up as being competition policy. But it's interesting because if you read what competition policy is, it's not competition at any cost. It's competition where it's in the best interests of consumers, and working on the premise that the private insurers or private organisations will be more innovative and will have more efficient pricing in doing so. And I would have thought that the market experience over the last couple of decades would highlight that in builder's warranty that isn't the case, and that therefore I think there are good arguments to say that competition policy does not mandate the need to have private insurers in builder's warranty. So, outcomes, just very quickly, last 25 years, there's only been two schemes that have made money or not gone broke or not need major restructuring, and that's been the Housing Guarantee Fund in Victoria, which operated mostly through the 90s, and the QBCC, which has certainly over the last 15 years been in very good shape. So you can obviously make your mind up as to what sort of scheme design and model you might prefer. I suspect I haven't left you in any doubt as to which I do. Thank you.
Thanks, Daniel and Cameron. That was fantastic. Time for a couple of questions, probably. Michael, were you here at the start or did you sneak in? Numbers have gone up. The word got around during the session. If you want to make your way to the microphone and because we're recording, give us your name and state your question clearly, that'd be good. Also, a reminder to fill in your feedback. I'll be giving very goods across the board. I thought that was fantastic.
No excellent.
I never give excellent. No, there's no excellent. I'm giving you top marks and you can talk to Wayne about how rare that is. Any takers? Otherwise, I have written a whole lot down here. One perhaps humorous, shouldn't have said that, might not be. That's right. In the diagram describing the Queensland system, you know, I've got a number of interests in this, including, you know, if you really want to, as an actuary, kind of understand a product, it's best to experience it. So I made a claim in Queensland a little while ago and it wasn't accepted. And I took that to QCAT. In the end, it was true that I was a bit late. But it was very interesting and amusing to me that the lawyer representing the BSA at the time, and it was a very civil meeting, said we can't accept your claim because it would just mess with the actuaries. They I stayed silent on, you know, that. But I thought it was really good, the influence of actuaries in these schemes. Anyone? Perhaps one thing. New South Wales, I've only kind of read the headlines, but they're opening up to the private market again. Are they envisaging again a private market operating with a government provider at the same time?
Again, I've only read the headlines as well.
I think what they're trying to do is make sure that they are seen to be enacting government policy. Government policy is for private insurance, not public insurance, and so they're trying to make sure the scheme is designed to say we allow it. I don't see any private insurers putting up their hand to come back in, so I'd be surprised if it has much of an impact.
Yeah, so it hasn't been through lobbying from the private insurers that this has come about. It's the government saying,
hey. That's not my understanding.
You want a piece of it, Andrew? Is that what you... Right. And you observed, and I guess it was a question that I had, given that you so clearly are equivocal about what kind of scheme is the best. Despite all the reviews, you know, we're not all turning into Queensland. And mostly that's really good across all sorts of things. But in this case, perhaps, you know, Queensland can go, hooray. Do you or the Institute ever make submissions to any of these reviews? Or is it left to... I don't know who it might be left to, but...
The Institute, I don't know, has made submissions to the reviews. I have, sort of, in terms of being asked opinion as opposed to providing a particular response. Interestingly, we didn't provide anything to the Western Australian review that happened 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, 2013.
2013. But they got my 2005 paper and kept quoting it and still ignored the message, it seems, so it wasn't much use. I think one of the problems is that lots of these reviews have an answer in mind before they happen, and if the government's policy is we don't write insurance, then the review will go through and come up with that conclusion, and it doesn't matter what evidence you put in front of it. So I don't know that there's much that certainly the Institute could do or should do in that space.
All right, well, no comment on how government policy operates. Thank you, Daniel and Cameron. I thought that was wonderful. Very good, at the very least. It's lunchtime, and I'll be presenting you two of these 5 bottles of wine for your enjoyment. Could everyone give them some well-earned thanks?